Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sunny Young in Washington. Welcome to the December 3rd edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's begin in Mali, where the country's iconic Bamako Hippodrome has reopened its traditional horse races on Sundays after months of being closed due to COVID-19. As youth flock to the races in droves, Annie Reisenberg tells us horses are ingrained in Mali's culture.
Every Sunday since 1946, spectators have flocked to the racetrack in Bamako's Hippodrome neighborhood, named after the track itself, to watch the horses run. Mahamadou Tangara was one of those spectators as a child. Now a professional jockey, he has won numerous championships and represented Mali in races abroad. Speaking from one of the stables beside the racetrack, which is on one of Bamako's main thoroughfares, Tangara explains the moment he decided to pursue this dream. He says he saw the great jockeys, how they raced their horses. So since that day, I decided, he says, that one day in the future, I'm going to be a jockey. The various empires that ruled Mali throughout its history depended on horses for transport and for the strength of their armies. Under French colonial rule, horse racing around a circular track was brought to Mali in the early 1900s. Mamadou Diarra speaks about the history of horses in Mali from the office of the Malian Federation of Equestrian Sports, where he serves as a general commissioner. He says there are so many cultural manifestations that are done by horse or around horses. Even in the past, he says, during the pre-colonial period, the power of an army was measured by its number of cavalry. In March, the races at Hippodrome were abruptly stopped due to COVID-19. For jockeys like Tangara, this meant a complete loss of income. On any given Sunday, a jockey can win between $91 and $182 in prize money. All I felt was difficulty, Tangara says. Just hard times. Because he says, if we work, we win something. He says, if we don't work, we win nothing. So we had 8 months where we didn't work. The races started up again on November 15th, and immediately, the sport's large, loyal audience returned to the track, where horses and excited audience members alike kick up the red dust. Before a race, Yakuba Donsoko, a sports journalist and race announcer, speaks near the racetrack about the importance of these races to the Malian public. He says equestrian sports play this main role in terms of the public who attend different activities. It's huge, he says. For my part, he says, I will say that in terms of the audience, it's number one. But soon after the races were reopened, COVID-19 cases again rose sharply in Mali. Some of the jockeys and the organizers wear masks, but most of the audience is indifferent to COVID precautions. Officials are now discussing new COVID-19 countermeasures, which could include shutting down the races. The jockeys would lose their livelihood again, but Donsoko says the community is ready to accept another shutdown if it will save lives. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Sport greetings, everyone. This is Falilat Ogukoya, Olympic silver and bronze medalist, African record holder, ran the best quarter-miler in the world, 1998. You are listening to the Sunny Side of Sport on Voice of America. Please continue to stay safe and avoid contracting COVID-19. Thanks.
In the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization
and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Now let's go to Ghana, where a young lady has ventured into mixed martial arts and is determined to reach the top of the fighting sport. Joining us now from the western region of Ghana is Yao Afusu-Larbi. Sporty greetings, Yao.
Sporty greetings, Sunny. Now, Nanajo has always been in love with sports. She started off with football, then boxing, before finally settling with mixed martial arts.
In Ghana, they didn't know the importance about the game. Maybe you are doing mixed martial arts, they will ask you what kind of the game is that. Unless you open up for that person. If you open your mind to listen to them, you will stop. I don't listen to others. I'm focused with my career. So that's why I'm so in the game.
The sports, although unpopular amongst many Ghanaians, has begun gaining ground in the country. The cage fighting is a full contact combat sport based on striking, grappling, and ground fighting, assimilating techniques from various combat sports like boxing, karate, kickboxing, judo, and martial arts from around the world of sports. It is beginning to gain some attention in Ghana. One of the fighters will have to surrender to give another a chance of winning. In the case of a knockout, the referee then steps in to call for the fight to end.
I want to fight to international level. When we are playing and they hate me and I wanted to return it back, then they will run. They said, don't come and kill you.
Nanajo hails from Kwabeng in Ghana's eastern region. It was from this sport that she began her quest to become one of only a few women to take up the sport. She was hugely supported by her mother, too.
My mom is my everything, apart from God. My mom is the one who do everything for me. When I started football, in life, if you don't take risk, it won't be good for you. Sometimes you will take risk to get what you want.
Being a lady in sport means maximum support. And in Nanajo's case, she has it in her coach, Victor Akom. Akom has been training Nanajo since she began in 2018. He talks through Nana's incredible professionalism and dedication to the quest.
Looking at her as a lady, and her willing, and her heart is in the art. That is the mixed martial art. It's not easy. We don't have much females. But based on Nanajua, I can boldly say that she just need a push. She just need a push because the spirit is there.
However challenging the quest is, Nanajua says she is ready to push it through and break barriers. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Yao Afusu-Larbi on Ghana's West Coast, Takrade.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
My name is Joshua Cheptegei of Uganda.
Ugandan runner Joshua Cheptegei is a top contender for a prize on Saturday when the World Athletics Awards 2020 are held. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, the ceremony will be staged as an online event and will be streamed live on the World Athletics YouTube channel, its Facebook page, and via Twitter. Cheptegei is a finalist for the Male Athlete of the Year award after setting 3 world records in 2020. In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2020, let's listen in again to a report from Magume Davis Rockawinge after Cheptegei set a new 5,000 meters world record. Sporty greetings, Magume.
Sporty greetings, Sunny. Ugandan won the Monaco Diamond League with a new world record, 12:35.36.
I felt so great, of course, upon crossing the finish line, knowing that I am really the new world record holder of the 5,000 meters. Really, I'm a happy man, of course, a happy Ugandan, and a happy African.
Cheptegei's new record replaced that of 12:37.35 set by Ethiopian Kenenisa Bekele in 2004 at Hengelo, Netherlands IAAF World Challenge meeting. He says he's grateful for his pacemakers, especially his training partner, fellow Ugandan Stephen Chisa.
I was training, of course, in these difficult times of the pandemic, of course, the coronavirus. Like most of the people, have been heartbroken, and people have lost dreams and, of course, focus. But as for me, of course, I was really motivated, of course, and having hope and keeping the faith that one time the world will get back to normal, and, of course, business will always resume.
The 2018 Commonwealth Games men's 5,000 and 10,000 meters champion also won gold in the 10,000 meters category, the Doha 2019 World Athletic Championships, and kept on winning form in various competitions across the globe.
In 2019, I won the World Cross Country, the Diamond Leaf Trophy in Zurich, and of course the World Championship in Doha. I always believe that one success, one goal, one success leads to another. Of course, it got me more hungry for more gold and for more wins and for more world records. So as an athlete, whenever I make an achievement, it becomes I celebrate it for once and for some few moments. And then, of course, I forget about it and, of course, look for new challenges in the future.
Namayo Mawerere is a spokesman for the Uganda Athletics Federation. He says amidst the COVID-19 pandemic, Cheptegei's success is a big motivation for other athletes in the country.
Certainly, Joshua Cheptegei has gone down in the world history and Ugandan records as one of the greatest athletes and sportsmen of all times. He has become an icon, a role model to the present and future Ugandan athletes. He has gone across a multiplier effect. Many Ugandan athletes have closely been following Cheptegei's path to glory with many attributes, which include patience, hard work, focus, big heart, willing to groom others, discipline, and strong determination to achieve his goals.
For the Sunny Side of Sports, I am Magume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Thanks, Magume. The energetic Andy Edwards has been talking this week with Charlie Spedding, Britain's 1984 Olympic bronze medalist in the men's marathon and the author of the autobiography From Last to First. The final part of their conversation begins with some of the injuries Charlie suffered during his running career, including a scary leg operation. Here's Andy.
You've won London, you have other good performances, but we're coming into 1988, the Olympics in Seoul, and you've had your ups and downs, injury problems. You had several surgical procedures on Achilles tendons. In fact, I mean, this is another extraordinary episode in the book. You almost died, didn't you, on the operating table, which should have been a routine anesthetic, went wrong.
Yes, this was, I was only about 23 years old and I needed an operation on my Achilles tendon, and I had what's known as an anaphylactic shock to one of the muscle relaxants and drugs they give you when you're having a general anaesthetic. He said if he hadn't noticed for a few more seconds, it might have been too late. It's like, you know, the swelling you get if you get stung by a bee? It's like having that happen to your entire body. My heart rate was accelerating, my blood pressure was plunging. And if I hadn't been in a hospital theatre when it happened, they had everything there that they needed to save me. But I spent 3 days in intensive care afterwards while they made sure that no permanent damage had been done to me. Clearly it hadn't, but it was a close call.
Did it affect the way you looked on life, on what you wanted to achieve in in running internationally?
No, I didn't have that. I'm lucky to be alive. I have to make the most of it. Type of experience. I just realized it had been a serious thing, but I'd got through it, and I just put it behind me and carried on. But I didn't have further problems with Achilles tendon surgery much later. You were talking about several years after Seoul. I had another Achilles operation in 1987. And that went wrong because the incision got infected. The skin below the stitches died, and I ended up with a hole through my skin through which you could see the Achilles tendon. And the operation had been to remove a little bit of adhesion from my Achilles tendon. And now the only thing that they could do was to allow the skin to grow back over my Achilles tendon, which it has done. And it is still completely attached. The year before Los Angeles, I'd won the 3A's 10,000 meters on the track. The summer before the Olympics in Seoul, I spent 3 months on crutches with a hole in my leg. So the preparation was very, very different. In the winter of 87-88, I was back to running, but I'd missed so much. I was really struggling to do well. But I think perhaps the story you're thinking about is this is absolutely true. One night I was running along a dark country lane that I knew very well, but you couldn't really see where I was going. I just knew it well enough to know where the different shades of grey told me where the edge of the road was. And there was a small hill on the way back home, and I was just too tired to run up it. And it wasn't a big hill. And I sat down in the dark, and I just thought about how I was struggling to run well. But the Olympics were coming, and I had this turmoil, and I thought, well, what have you always wanted to do? And I've always wanted to run the Olympic Games, and I've got maybe one more chance. I can either sit here and mope about how unfit I am, or I can try to get there. So I made up my mind that I was going to do my utmost to get to Seoul. So I stood up and I walked up the hill and then ran the rest of the way home, but continued to work and train and slowly, very slowly, get better and fitter.
So you get to Seoul, you're in the Olympic marathon. Interesting, beforehand, I mean, you mentioned, and I was in Seoul in 88 as a journalist, and you say, well, you could see team members, probably people also who had finished their event, and not just in athletics, but in Seoul, lots of high-tech gear available, people going shopping, in other words, and everything. And yet you said you never left the Olympic Village. I mean, you did your training runs, but you basically stayed there. You were in a different frame of mind compared to 4 years before in Los Angeles. Intent on going to do well, but one gets the feeling of you were in much more turmoil for the Seoul Marathon.
Yes, in Los Angeles, I was convinced, completely convinced that I was in the physical and mental shape of my life, and I was going to run the race of my life. My training and racing going to Seoul just had not been as good, and I was concerned about how I was going to do. So I wasn't interested in any distractions at all. I stayed in the Olympic Village, apart from training runs that I went on, and I just tried to focus and concentrate on producing the best performance I could, though I had no idea really what that was going to be. And to cut a long story short, I finished sixth in that race, and I am still to this day amazed that I did that when I look back at my training diaries and the races I ran. I hadn't run a really good race for a year and a half before Seoul, and somehow dragged out a performance better than I thought I could. But I think that, again, comes back to the power of the mind.
Do you make yourself a promise when you're going through a very hard patch in the Olympic Marathon in Seoul? So tell us more about this promise that you made to yourself. And the last part of our chat is how life plays its tricks. you ended up breaking the promise. But first of all, the promise that gets you to the finish line of the Olympic marathon in Seoul in 88.
I was about 3 or 4 miles from the finish. I was in sixth place. There was a big gap in front of me. There was a big gap behind me. But it was extremely hot. I was dehydrated. My legs were like blocks of wood. My muscles were so tight, there was no bounce. Every stride hurt. My mind was screaming at me to just stop and lie down. I was not going to do that. I was in sixth place and nothing to be ashamed of. So I was determined that I was finished. I was going to get myself somehow to the finish. And I was doing every mental trick I could to keep myself going. And at one point, when half of my mind was saying, you shouldn't be running marathons, stop, I said, well, I promise I'll never do another one if all the voices in my mind work together to get me to the finish line. I had to focus unbelievably hard on the yards in front of me and putting one foot in front of another to keep going. And I got there, and I really thought that I would never run another marathon. But the trouble was that having finished sixth in the Olympics, lots of people said, we're not going to retire now when you're running so well. And, of course, you forget how hard it was as years go by. But actually, I did try to run other marathons. But the truth is, I never finished another marathon.
Because you finish, obviously it's at the end of the book, but you say something like, my marathon career finished sitting on the curbside of a road in Japan, dropping out of Fukuoka, DNFing, as we say in the trade, did not finish, waiting for the pickup car.
Yes. Yeah, that was the glorious end to my career. But I've always thought that about high jumpers. They always finish with failure, don't they? Even when they've won. That was the end. I tried to extract every ounce out of my marathon running career, and it was probably inevitable that you're going to end with failure, unless I had actually stuck to retiring at the end of Seoul. But I thought, well, I'm still in my 30s. Perhaps I can still do it. And you know, I'm going to spend many decades when there's no possibility of me running well. There may be a possibility of me running well for a couple of years. So I was persuaded to try again, but I didn't actually finish another race.
Charlie, I think your autobiography, From Last to First, and you talk about getting immense satisfaction out of taking your abilities to the limit. I've always enjoyed talking with you. Thank you very much, Charlie Spedding, for this interview.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Basketball superstar LeBron James has agreed to a 2-year contract extension with the NBA champion Los Angeles Lakers. The Los Angeles Times newspaper reports the deal is worth $85 million and goes through the 2022-2023 season. LeBron will celebrate his 36th birthday on December 30th. He and the Lakers will begin defense of their NBA title on December 22nd when they tip off the regular season against their city rival, the Los Angeles Clippers, at Staples Center Arena. Staples Center is also where the Lakers honored another superstar player, the late Kobe Bryant, back in February. In this Sunny Side of Sports highlight for 2020, VOA's Jim Stevenson looks back on Kobe's memorial service.
Monday was a day of remembrance for National Basketball Association great Kobe Bryant and his 13-year-old daughter Gianna, who were among 9 people killed in a helicopter crash in January. Speaking at Times Through Tears, Vanessa Bryant praised her husband's devotion to their family as she addressed thousands of fans gathered at the Staples Center in Los Angeles.
Kobe was the MVP of Girl Dads, or MVD. He never left the toilet seat up. He always told the girls how beautiful and smart they are. He taught them how to be brave and how to keep pushing forward when things get tough. God knew they couldn't be on this earth without each other.
WNBA star Diana Taurasi spoke of how Kobe Bryant's talent was very evident in his daughter.
The same passion we all recognized in Kobe, obviously Gigi inherited. Her skill was undeniable at an early age. I mean, who has a turnaround fadeaway jumper at 11?
The arena was filled with many of the top NBA players, present and past. Perhaps the best of all time, Michael Jordan, recalled the early days of his interactions with Kobe Bryant.
He used to call me, text me, 11:30, 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. At first, it was an aggravation, but then it turned into a certain passion. This kid had passion like you would never know.
That intense passion for basketball inspired the man who himself inspired millions who love the sport.
What Kobe Bryant was to me was the inspiration that someone truly cared about the way I played the game or the way that he wanted to play the game. He wanted to be the best basketball player that he could be. And as I got to know him, I wanted to be the best big brother that I could be.
Michael Jordan could not hold back his tears as he spoke. Known for his practical jokes, Jordan says Kobe Bryant's final joke on him will be a crying meme.
Now he's got me. I told my wife I wasn't going to do this because I didn't want to see that for the next 3 or 4 years. That is what Kobe Bryant does to me.
Kobe Bryant played his entire 20-year NBA career with the Los Angeles Lakers. Now, images of the five-time NBA champion are appearing all over Los Angeles. The murals became a place for fans like Deanna Ortega to gather, grieve, and reminisce.
We're here just to, you know, show love for Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna, and just wanted to come to L.A. and just show some love and take a picture of Kobe Bryant's mural right here.
One such mural can be found in the La Brea neighborhood. Created by an L.A.-based street artist, this mural features newspaper articles highlighting Bryant's career accomplishments and some of his iconic and inspiring quotes. The tribute is also unique as it invites fans like Jolyn and Jason to make their mark on the artwork by writing messages for their fallen hero.
Because he was also a legend for everyone, not only in the game for basketball, but for everyone in their life. He inspired everyone to push themselves to do their best. In my opinion, I really think that having murals of Kobe Bryant and Gigi is honestly, like, something everyone would remember.
He was like an icon, you know, like, real good basketball player, you know, like, family man. Just see how he is with his kids, and he just always had that positive attitude, and just, he was just idolized. He was one of my favorite basketball players growing up, him and Michael Jordan.
Another mural in Melrose is outside of Shoe Palace, a popular streetwear store. Visitors are encouraged to plaster post-it notes with messages for the L.A. Lakers star. Ruben Menyane is manager of Shoe Palace.
We started when we heard of the passing. We saw a lot of people started to show up, bring some flowers and some memorabilia, and wanting to put notes. So I took out some notepads, started writing a few, give my employees and the platform for everybody to want. So we had a bunch of pens, marker, post-it notes so people could leave a mark. Remember Kobe, the good moments, the bad moments, what Kobe meant to them.
Mural artist J.C. Rose says he felt bittersweet as his creation 4 years ago is now more meaningful and important to the community with the basketball legend's passing.
I think it's something special and something unique about the paper being fragile and that the messages on each note is so meaningful. Like, I feel like maybe we all found out that life is both fragile and meaningful.
Kobe Bryant and his daughter were buried February 7th in a private ceremony near the family's Southern California home.
And thanks to VOA's Jim Stevenson for that report. In more NBA news, the Washington Wizards have traded star guard John Wall to the Houston Rockets for 9-time All-Star Russell Westbrook. The Washington Post newspaper on Thursday described the deal in a big headline as changing of the guard.
Wall is a five-time NBA All-Star, but he's been sidelined the past two seasons after tearing his Achilles tendon. Westbrook won the NBA's Most Valuable Player Award in 2017, and he'll now team up with another star guard, Bradley Beal, in the Wizards' backcourt. And that wraps up the December 3rd edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.